Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, your excited host today, because our guest is Mark Netter, the writer, director, producer of a science fiction thriller, techno-thriller indie film called Nightmare Code. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you so much, Summer.
Now, Nightmare Code has been around the indie circuit. It won the 2015 Philip K. Dick Science Fiction Film Festival earlier this year and is just now coming out on digital platforms and will be coming out on DVD at the end of October, right?
DVD actually has been moved to the end of November, so we can include the commentary track and other extras. The commentary track is not just me, but it's our two lead actors, Andrew J. West from Walking Dead and Mae Malanson from X-Men The Last Stand. And we are out right now on iTunes, Google Play, YouTube Movies, Vudu, and we've got other platforms that will be coming over the next month or two.
Excellent. And I am a fan of extras on DVDs and Blu-rays, so I'm glad to hear there's a commentary track.
Yeah, and we have some videos that we made originally for our Indiegogo campaign that include kind of a behind-the-scenes, something about the characters in the movie, and another video which we call Technology and Fear, which I guess at some level is what the movie is about.
Ooh. Well, give our listeners a brief synopsis of Nightmare Code.
Sure. Nightmare Code is a psychological sci-fi thriller about behavior recognition technology, which would be, if there's a camera on you and me right now and someone's watching on a monitor, they would be able to see what we're thinking and feeling, not just what we're saying. It's about behavior modification, 24/7 surveillance, and artificial intelligence going out of control. And it takes place in a troubled startup that they're working on a program called Roper that ropes in all the video in the area and analyzes it. But the previous lead programmer, an older guy, old school guy, has gone on a murder-suicide spree. And what's left is a very small four-person QA team, an outsourcing of the code to India. And a young programmer is brought in named Brett Desmond, and that's played by Andrew J. West. And he's a hotshot programmer, but he's got some trouble in his past, and he has 1 month to help them finish this in order to be able to erase his past legal problems, which are some kind of WikiLeaks type problems, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Along the way, he becomes, he's talking to his wife and daughter over Skype or video chat at night, talking to his buddy who helped him with the leak, talking to the lead programmer in India. And this is all while he's living, sleeping, working in these almost abandoned offices with just the four other workers there, one of whom is a QA tester named Nora Huntsman, with whom he starts to become closer and more involved. And as he works on the program, the deeper he goes into Roper, the more Roper starts to rewrite itself, seems to take on an intelligence of its own, and the more it actually starts to modify Brett's behavior and destabilize him and make his behavior match that of his predecessor, the homicidal programmer. The whole movie is told with surveillance camera, with PC cam, eyeglass cam, and surveillance cams. The eyeglass cameras at times are actually worn by the actors. And for a lot of the movie, you're watching, and more than half, I'd say, you're watching four images at once, like a surveillance monitor, but they're not always in sync. And the idea is to give the viewer the sense that perhaps Roper himself, the computer program, is telling you the story. And sometimes we like to say that, imagine The Shining set in a software startup as told by Hal from 2001.
Wow, that's a heady image. Well, I really enjoyed this movie from our reviewer, Sean. He has a programming background. I have a tech and administrative and programming background. And watching the split screen, the four screens, even when they're out of sync, it made sense to me because it seemed like Roper was observing certain things in real time and maybe processing some of the other stuff in the background, and that's why there was a delay on some of the other sequences. There were some sequences that were interestingly done. I'll get to that later, but the idea that the software was sentient and trying to figure out the people in its immediate vicinity in order to figure out how to manipulate them, how to get them to go along. I was like, wow, our first AI is sociopathic. How special.
Yeah, no, I mean, definitely we want the movie to start a discussion along with the thrills of the movie and the suspense and, you know, the shocks. We really wanted the movie to start a conversation about technology. You know, I believe that the tools of the past were tools that, you know, you could eventually observe and understand how they worked. A pulley system, an elevator of the old days, whatever it would be, you would understand how that worked if you looked at the pieces. I don't think, aside from some very smart programmers out there, most people understand how our current technological tools really work. And not only do I think that our tools have grown so powerful that they're growing beyond our control, but I think that we also are increasingly ceding more and more control over our lives and our humanity to our technology,
mm-hmm.
whether it's, you know, pre-programmed appointments in your phone, whether it's applying for a job and having to go through an online process where if you don't say the right words, the computer program isn't going to put your resume through to a human HR person. We now have self-driving cars through Google and heaven forbid, I understand people are already starting to hack them, but heaven forbid at some point somebody tries to hack them and decides that all the cars in one town need to meet at one intersection at 60 miles an hour. Or if the computer ultimately decides, as computers become more and more, it's predicted that computers will actually, there will be a sentient computer program possibly as early as 2022. And I think in our movie, we're positing maybe this has happened already, but it's happened in a startup someplace you just don't know it yet.
Some friends of mine and I have joked for years that Google in our universe would actually be Skynet, and the fact that they have self-driving cars, those would be the prototypes for the first Terminator. So we're on our way.
Oh, scary. Very scary. It's interesting because somebody last night at a screening in New York City told me that they thought of our movie as a prequel to The Matrix.
There you go.
There you go. First time I've heard that, but I like it.
Huh. Interesting. So we have a prequel to The Matrix, which means we have sentient... Yeah. The first people it pulls in are the first agents. There you go.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I can see that. So let's talk about the story itself. How did the story get developed? Because you and MJ Rotondi co-wrote this, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. He's a creative partner and you know, on the writing, he actually has been the person who I've shown every, you know, actor audition video to, every cut of the movie, really, and ultimately became co-executive producer because of his sticking with the movie. And which is tough on an independent feature where nobody's getting paid. So, and we live on opposite sides of the country. He's in New York, I'm in Los Angeles. But essentially the way it started was with another person, our lead executive producer, Craig Allen. He was somebody I had lunch with in January 2012. He, at that time, was CEO of an independent video game company called Spark Unlimited, which is where we actually shot the movie. And we came up with an idea that he agreed to put money into through the company. And that the core idea of Nightmare Code is something I learned about programmers when I worked in the video game industry years ago. I am not a programmer. I'm an avid iPhone 6 Plus user right now. But when I first joined the video game business, which was in the 90s, I would have thought that if you gave the same task to two programmers of similar skill, that the code they write would be 95% similar. You put it side by side, it would look almost identical. What I learned is that good programmers or different programmers can actually solve the same problem different ways.
Mm-hmm.
We would, you know, you bring in a new programmer and they would do it, in an open book test on the whiteboard, and our lead programmer would say, oh, we solved that totally differently, but you're hired. So what that said to me, and Craig agreed with this, is that deep inside of the code, whether it's inside my 6 Plus or your iPhone or whatever smartphone you have, deep inside the DOS kernel that's still inside of Windows, there is the personality of a programmer or multiple programmers that is expressed as logic. And in fact, some programmers actually have told me that they consider that their immortality, that they are going to, they've created code that's going to live on beyond their own lives. That's their mark on civilization. So our idea is, what if this logic, what if this personality were actually sentient? And since we were making kind of a sci-fi film with some horror overtones to it, what if we were extremely pissed off? Everything flowed from there. And we came up with the idea of having this happen all in one location. And I really did think about The Shining and other movies like Alien or John Carpenter's The Thing, where you're in one location, but you really kind of get to know the geography of the location. And it becomes a really interesting maze, maybe a trap for the characters, so that the audience gets a certain sense of familiarity when things really go awry and really go crazy, that maybe it has that much more impact and maybe makes them feel that much more voyeuristic about it, especially when we came up with the idea of doing it all with surveillance camera and PC cam and eyeglass cam, that you would really not only know the location well by the time you get to where things start going wildly off the rails, but you would also know the very shots, you'd know those angles. So you might have seen someone walking down a hallway without anything bad happening in the first half hour of the movie, but in the last half hour, you're seeing someone running for their life down that hallway.
Yeah, the shot choice I thought was very effective, because you have the four screens, the four camera angles, the four different locations all at the screen at the same time. And to me, that added a little bit to the increasing claustrophobic effect as the tension that people were feeling ramped up as the film progressed. And I don't know if that was intentional or if that was just how I was seeing it, but I, you know, that as things get tenser and tenser, those four smaller screens kind of amplify the tension, and I like it.
Oh, that's good. Well, I've had somebody tell me it's tense from the beginning, but it's fun tension, which is kind of like how I watch a Hitchcock movie like Psycho.
Yeah, it's what a thriller should be.
Yeah, you know, and I think if you care about the characters, and in this case, I think, you know, well, I'll get into that in a sec, but I think you're right about the way that the tension ratchets up. And, you know, we break up those four, this, you know, it's not always, you know, just four images at once. Mm-hmm. We'll go to wide, you know, a full image of the entire screen, or sometimes you'll see this stuff where the eyeglass camera or the actors are literally wearing the camera, which is a Roper camera, Roper the program. It's actually analyzing people's behavior on the fly as somebody walks through the office. And in particular, there's a scene at the end of the first act, which you see actually what happened in the office before Brett got there.
Right.
Because he uncovers some video, and it really puts the audience in a position that is very voyeuristic, very tense. And you're kind of watching from the point of view of essentially the most dangerous person in the movie. So we really did a lot to kind of use those to ratchet up the tension, but also I really wanted to get the feeling that Roper was telling the story. So when we go to a full screen image, what's the reason we're doing it? Well, it's because Roper wants to show you there's a knife in the office, or Roper wants to show you that the character really is trapped, that he's more powerful than we are. And it became really interesting as a way also to keep the viewer interested and keep your eye moving around. I mean, I've had people tell me that they've watched the film two or three times because they thought they might have missed something in some of the frames, because your attention goes to different frames at different right. times when you watch the movie. We also like the idea that sometimes you'll wait for somebody to walk from maybe the top left quad to the top right quad, and they don't always do it, and it keeps you guessing and keeps your mind working throughout.
It's definitely a way to increase engagement and prevent trips to the bathroom.
Well, you know, what's funny, too, is the younger our audiences are, the more it's just second nature for them.
Yeah.
I've got two boys, 15 and 12, and, you know, given their opportunity, if they're watching TV, they'll do it with an iPhone or an iPad in their hands.
And
so
there are,
multiple screens aren't a problem.
Yeah, and there are TV shows now that actually incorporate an online component. You'll see a little tag at the bottom. Go here to find out more about how the scene was created or stuff. And they're actually encouraging more interaction by telling you to get online and go find this little extra before waiting a year for it to come out as a special something on DVD or Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing. And Picture in Picture has been around for a while. Mm-hmm. People do that to preview what they're going to watch next. So, you know, it's been a really good, from the visual point of view. And I'd say, again, you know, using Roper as the organizing principle for the editing, it even went to the special effects. A great company in L.A. called Psychic Bunny, also on our crazy low budget, did an unbelievable job with over 600 visual effects in the movie, not just the Roper interface, but, you know, all kinds of LUT effects and things you wouldn't even know were effects, the video chat. And there's one scene in particular, and I'm going to try to do this without spoilers, but there's one particular scene where there's some 3D animation, let's say, and a conversation. And during this conversation, they had some effects going, some glitches. And when I first saw it, I thought they were all in the wrong place and it didn't work for me, and I explained it to them. And I came back a week later, and this was at night because I was making the film working at night while I was doing a day job. And we actually shot the film over 7 weekends. But I come back a week later, and it's fantastic. It's almost exactly what you see right now in the movie. And I was actually laughing because it was so good, and I turned to them and I said, what's different? And they said to me, we're thinking like Roper now.
Nice. So did creating those split screens provide an extra challenge when editing or when shooting?
Well, more when editing. We really shot the movie with the idea of the surveillance. And my thinking was that both for a budgetary standpoint, it allowed us to get a lot of pages done quickly. We shot the movie in 14 days over 7 weekends. And, if you're going to make a low-budget independent feature, a lot of people do found footage films with shaky cam and handheld camera because that's also a way to work really quickly. But to me, I wanted to make something where the images were, I think, more powerful than you get with those found footage movies. So those are great for energy and sometimes for fear, but I thought we could do something really great where these images would be so memorable that you would maybe they'd stick in your head longer because of the surveillance nature of the PC cameras where you get the close-ups of the actors where they're really close to the image, like you would be for your computer. So the big challenge in the editing was to make the footage look even more surveillance-y. How do we really sell that? And we came up with the idea of the clock at that point. And it was so interesting to me to be able to play with a lot of times we did shoot two camera and one, the big kind of scene that we talked about earlier, we shot with five cameras. But then the idea became that how do we fill in the other frames? And a lot of it came the idea of we fill it in with other shots from other places. We fill it in with Roper trying to make duplicates of some of the other frames. In the beginning of the movie, it looks very staticky. As the movie goes on, those become clearer and clearer. And you really see, as one of the, without getting too spoilery, one of the kind of twists in the story is how Roper is able to play with video reality and start to really make you question the reality of what you're seeing. So it was a challenge, but it also was, I have to tell you, for someone who enjoys editing, it was a blast. And it was a way to really play with the actor performances and to, in essence, give the audience more than they would have gotten with just, straight cutting the whole way through everything full frame. The movie is 89 minutes, but there's enough material in there for, two or three movies.
Yeah. And to me, it is found footage. It's just found, it's Big Brother found footage because we've seen think about it. We've got Person of Interest, which uses surveillance cameras to help figure out the mystery or where to go. We have, what's the other movie? Oh, I just had it. We've seen how they used surveillance footage to track people in, what was it, the last two Bourne movies? We've seen it in, do you remember a movie called Enemy of the State with Gene Hackman and Will Smith?
Yeah, very cool.
And that I thought was intriguing because there was a, not really a rumor, but a a background story that perhaps Gene Hackman's character in that movie was an older version of his character from the movie The Conversation, which was also about surveillance. You have these analysts analyzing audio tapes, audio conversations with no context whatsoever. They're just listening to them, transcribing them. And I just thought that was just literally, we've seen the progression of surveillance and how we have algorithms making that surveillance more effective because they can actually analyze the images without human input now. And you're like, okay, is this going?
Where is this going? Well, it's great that you mentioned The Conversation. I mean, it's funny, I wasn't thinking about it earlier, but that is, you know, a big influence on my thinking about, you know, a lot of that is somebody who's actually just listening to tapes and sounds and trying to figure out a mystery. And a part of our movie, when Brett, the young programmer, goes into the previous programmer, whose name was Foster Cotton, played by Judy Gress, you might have seen in Apollo 13 or Armageddon, goes into his computer, he finds that Foster stored all these old videos, and he's kind of pouring through those. And the other thing that really struck me about The Conversation, too, is the way it handled violence, where it is so sudden and feels so real, and it's almost out of the blue. And I really wanted in our movie, when bad things happen, I really wanted it to feel, let's say, more real than it would at your average superhero, you know, Hollywood movie. That it would actually, I had one person who saw it the other night, he said they felt every gunshot.
Yeah, because you've been with these people throughout the entire film in such, I'm going to, you know, close-up, intimate settings, because most of the time, they're, what, a foot and a half away from the monitor? So you really get a sense of connection with them, and then to see the, boom, they're just gone. You're like, whoa. And it does impact you emotionally, because you've connected with them. And you saw that, you had that in the one scene where Brett is actually watching the first massacre in the office, where he literally can't watch Cotton killing himself.
Yeah, he has to turn away. Now, can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things I'd love to ask, I'm very proud of get a big head, but I'm very proud of the performances in the movie. And basically because these actors came and they knew they were in a low-budget movie, but they were so committed because they loved the story and because they had a chance to do some things they don't always get to do. And I wanted to know if you had a favorite character in the movie.
A favorite character? I'm not sure
That's a crazy question.
I'm not sure I had a particular favorite. I liked Nora's spunkiness, the way she tried to keep the other two guys who were always goofing around, you know, she'd let them goof around and then try to pull them in, rein them in, having much experience herding cats, I know what that's like. I'm not sure that there's one particular one that I connected with more than the others, but the way the relationships between everybody felt natural. Even when Brett coming in as the outsider, the hired gun, he kind of laid back for a couple of days and then just literally fell in sync with the others because they were speaking the same language, which is the language of coding. And is something that, like I said, I have a lot of experience with, not as a programmer, but as a systems administrator. I would be the person who would jump in there and poke around in the command line level when something was, you know, a server was not behaving well. I'd get in there and go, okay, what are you doing today? Talk to me. And literally sometimes in some jobs that I've had, people would call to the help desk and say, hey, this isn't working. I'd walk down to their office and it would literally stop the moment I walked in the office because the computer thought, oh, she's coming in here. I better behave myself. I literally One coworker said, "Yeah, you've got the aura." I'm like, "The what?" Like the computer realizes that they've called you for help and you're going to figure out the problem and stop it, so they behave. I'm like, "Okay, now you're scaring me." And this
making me
was,
think Ropers has been around longer than I thought.
I truly believe that there are gremlins in the machine. I have seen enough strange behavior at the core level of many different flavors of Unix over my time. And I believe every now and then there's a gremlin and they're running around going, "Okay, what can I do now? Oops, the sysadmin's watching, better lay low."
Oh my goodness.
So,
it's
yeah,
funny.
It's just the camaraderie that coding makes is something that I'm familiar with, and watching that interaction with the different personalities where everything they had in common was the code. And I appreciated that. So my question from that is, did you guys have programmers as story consultants or acting consultants?
Great question. Well, my co-writer, NJ Rotondi, learned how to program years ago. He was actually taught by IBM. You know, back in the day, I don't know if it was COBOL or Fortran or, you know, one
probably
of the
both
ancient languages. So he was able to, and he did the first pass on the dialogue. The way that we actually wrote the movie was interesting because after this lunch, I didn't want to lose Craig's interest. I was worried that if I just wrote the movie myself or tried to, that I'd get in my own way. I called Michael in New York and I said, "Look, if you co-write this with me, the way it'll work is I'll write a treatment, which is essentially kind of like a prose version of the story, getting the ideas out and the basics of the scenes. And you do the scripting, which is dialogue and figuring out how the scene actually works. Just stay 5 pages behind me." And so the first pass of all the dialogue, except for a few lines here or there, were all his. And then we were able to polish it together and continue polishing it. But it was great because it meant that we actually delivered the script 40 days to the day after that lunch.
Uh-huh.
And Craig, he talks about opening the script with trepidation that either he wouldn't like it and have to tell me, you know, his friend that he wasn't going to back the movie, or that he would like it and actually have to back the movie. And fortunately, he did like it. We took some notes from him. He was really into a lot of some of the philosophy in the movie where it talks about the idea of, you know, what would human consciousness inside of a machine be like. And we took that and we did a little, got some other notes and we did a rewrite, and then we went out to actors and we were shooting literally less than 6 months after that lunch, which is almost impossible. And in a real Hollywood movie with a big budget would never happen that quickly.
Right.
So we were able to work really quickly and Michael was able to bring a lot of that understanding to the table. We, you know, did have some other people we showed it to. We got some advice. We were able to pull some things offline to make the things that were written on whiteboards look correct. And then ultimately, Psychic Bunny, the team in LA that did the special effects, they did all of the computer screens. And I've had programmers come up to me after screenings and say, "Oh, you used, you know, GNOME or whatever it is, like a particular type of program or operating system or whatever is on the screen." And you know, I've never seen a movie be so accurate about that, and all I can do is say nod and say thank you, but it's not coming from me. I had no idea. I just wanted it to look real. One thing that I did have input into, though, is if you look at the titles at the beginning of the movie when the title comes up, and I wanted it's been a very old school font that you might remember from back in the old days, that kind of amber font that really you would not see on a computer these days. One thing I really loved about wanting to do with Nightmare Code was to have that feeling of kind of the programmers from the past. And we even use a song, "Baby Please Don't Go," and a blues song that different people hum over the movie. In fact, it kind of spreads a little bit, and that's a sort of a sense that maybe the viral thinking is spreading. And I wanted that sense of something from the past, because a lot of tech movies that I see, they kind of rely on a sheen of kind of a technological sheen, and I think it can make you feel very distant from what you're watching and kind of lacking a soul, perhaps. And I wanted our movie, even though it's obviously very techy and it's got the quads and the Roper point of view, the first movie told from the point of view of an AI, I wanted it to have some soul to it. And both through kind of the music and kind of that old school programming touch, and Foster Cotton being an old school programmer. the previous, homicidal programmer. Hopefully we got that across.
Yes, I actually was a fan of the old amber text on a black screen or the green text on the black screen.
That was Matrix, though. We didn't want to do exactly what the Matrix had done, so we went
Right.
amber.
But you could always say the green text on the black background was also War Games, so
Oh, that's going back.
going way back.
Yeah, great one.
So how did this movie end up at the Philip K. Dick Science Fiction Film Festival? Because it actually, with the ratcheting up of the paranoia and the surveillance, it fits right in with Philip K. Dick's
Well,
over.
we were lucky that, I appreciate that. We were lucky to enter and that it got recognized and selected for the festival, and then it played just great there in January in New York. And then when we actually won the, essentially the top award at the festival, and there are other great films there, actually made some great friendships out of it, that won other awards. But it was just the idea that we were the most in the spirit of Philip K. Dick is extremely meaningful to me and Michael, my co-writer, and I think really fits the film. Philip K. Dick, I'm guessing that your listeners know this, but the science fiction author no longer alive who was behind the movies that became, well, the stories that became Blade Runner, Minority Report, which is actually a TV series now, Man in the High Castle, which is an Amazon TV series, Total Recall, which has been made twice, Adjustment Bureau. And he was really the pioneer in technological paranoia. A lot of writing in the 70s and 60s that was about how people were being watched, that you can't even trust the reality that you're living in. Really mind-blowing books like, my personal favorite is Flow of My Tears, The Policeman Said, which, helped me to make sense of it someday, but it doesn't matter. I just love that book. So the idea that we are somehow carrying on that tradition and can have that name associated with Nightmare Code is quite an honor. And hopefully fans of Philip K. Dick will, seek out Nightmare Code and enjoy it and feel like we kind of, honored the master in our work.
So there was actually no intent to emulate any of his, I'm going to say, philosophies going into writing the movie. It just turned out that way.
I think that you're influenced by all the things you read and you put in, and you try to advance it to the next level. I mean, I think that another big influence on the movie, besides Philip K. Dick and Stanley Kubrick, was some of the movies of David Cronenberg. I'm a big fan of Videodrome, which I think is just a crazy psychotic movie, and that's where somebody's controlled by videotapes that are being put into his belly, since it was made back in the VHS era, and in some sort of supernatural slit that's been created in this guy's belly or sci-fi slit. And it actually plays him and makes the main character in that more of an assassin. So, I think all that stuff kind of definitely had impact on us. It definitely, Michael and I, my co-writer, we have similar frames of reference. We spent a lot of time talking about movies before we ever wrote anything together and certain books. And I think that there's we're kind of in an age now where even at this low budget level that we work at, we're able to execute a science fiction vision believably in ways that, back when Philip K. Dick was writing in the 70s, it was really difficult to turn his books into movies. I mean, Blade Runner was the very first one to do it and at a huge cost. So I think all those things influence us in different ways. And there's nothing where we specifically said, hey, we're taking this directly from Philip K. Dick, but there's no question that he was in the discussion while we were writing the movie.
Now, what other festivals has this played at?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. In fact, this first weekend in October is the annual Shriek Fest in Los Angeles, and we played there last year. It was our world premiere, and we won the Best Thriller Award. They give out three top awards: Best Horror Film, Best Thriller, Best Sci-Fi Film. And Denise Gossett there is a huge, helpful fan of the movie. As she said to me, it's a movie that doesn't just make you feel, but makes you think. And personally invited us to the festival. So that's been a really big one for us. We played at several other ones, Philadelphia Independent Film Festival. We played at Crypticon in Seattle. We played in, we've had our debut in England at the Derby Film Festival there, and their Cinema Fantastic section of their festival. And there's several others out there as well. And obviously now with it available on iTunes and Google Play and other places, it's less likely that we'll be in any more festivals. But we are doing, where we can, we're doing these influencer screenings around the country. And, you know, I guess if someone is really interested in having a screening in their school or their town, they should just send us a message through our Facebook page where you can catch up on all of the things that are happening with Nightmare Code, the reviews, the interviews, and we'll be posting this, of course. And it also, we're posting articles that we're seeing in the news every day about themes that are in the real world very similar to things that are happening in Nightmare Code, whether it's about surveillance, facial recognition, what have you, AI.
Awesome. Well, I enjoyed this. I have no problem encouraging other eggheads and coder geeks to check this out, and fans of Philip K. Dick and fans of thrillers in general might actually find this surprisingly enjoyable. It's one of those things where I'm not going to watch that, but when you hear what it's really about, you know, maybe change their minds, because I know Sean really, really enjoyed it. It was one little thing he was curious about, but we'll let it slide because I see where it was going, and I'm like, yeah, okay. We little sleight of hand, no problem. But everything else in the story was just so spot on.
Well, we appreciate that so much. I also want to say, too, just in case anyone's getting scared out there, that, you know, I've had plenty of people like myself who are not programmers, but plenty of people tell me that they know nothing about programming and they still understood what was going on in the movie every moment because emotionally it all made sense. I mean, you know, I can see a movie about somebody building a bridge and not know anything about bridge building, but, you know, be able to follow it because of the way the filmmaker tells the story. So we really wanted to be the dialogue or the jargon to be believable so that you would feel like you were in a real world. But we also took great pains to make sure that there was nothing that you wouldn't understand just based, like you said, on the relationship, the realistic nature of the relationships. And I would say that I just want to do a special call out to our two lead actors, especially Andrew J. West as the programmer, Brett Desmond. You know, I find him to be a very relatable character and actor, and I just think he does a great job of showing you this programmer. He's got a little bit of ego at the beginning. He's going to find that challenged as the his work on the code goes on in the movie. But he and Nate Melanson as Nora Huntsman just really do a great job of kind of leading the cast through this technical world without alienating viewers that might not know anything about technology.
Mm-hmm. And I think it would be easy for someone who's not as familiar with technology to connect with that, because everybody knows somebody who either works on computers 15 hours a day or plays console games online 15 hours a day. There's a similar level of focused obsession that goes into that kind of concentration, and a skill develops from that on both sides. And people know people like that. So I think there's a good chance for the average non-techie to connect with these people because they know somebody who's like them.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I mean, a lot of us are on the computers much more than maybe we should be. So
yeah.
You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Well, it's funny. I've actually had somebody say to me that after they watched the movie, they didn't touch their iPhone for the rest of the night.
Well, that's just paranoid because you're wondering, okay, what is Siri really thinking about me? So what else? Are you working on anything new yet or have anything planned?
We sure are. One thing we talked about is the possibility of expanding Nightmare Code into maybe a series of some sort. That even though the ending, and again, not to be spoilerish, it's got some apocalyptic overtones, there is the possibility of continuing the story with new characters as well as the few surviving characters, and that's a tough one. But the other thing is that we've written a new script. It's another thriller. We're really interested in staying in suspense. This one is not a science fiction thriller. It takes place in a town that's got an army base, and the twist is that it's a thriller with four women, four female leads, with various kind of associations with the military, that for various injustices that they kind of suffer, particularly at the hands of certain men, they enter into a blackmail scheme. And this blackmail scheme goes horribly awry and becomes a kidnapping, murder, and betrayal. The things that make America great. And that one is called All the Way Down. And I'm very excited. We're almost finished with the script, with a new draft of the script. And I'm really hoping that Nightmare Code enables us to have the credibility to make this next one, to go bigger budget, to have the camera move and not be fixed and not be a surveillance movie, and just keep working in this kind of vein of suspenseful films about people that you can relate to in increasingly desperate situations.
Awesome. Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Summer. I love this conversation. I love particularly that you bring this particular technological perspective to it, and this has been a lot of fun.
Well, like you said, programming background, old school sci-fi background, Philip K. Dick fan, it all kind of meshes right there. The only thing missing, I think, was a little wink, wink, nod, nod towards Lovecraft.
Well,
But
one of the big questions that we want to leave people with in the movie is Roper just an incredibly advanced form of AI, or is there actually a human personality that has entered the machine and is controlling things? And I think that's hopefully a discussion people will enjoy having after they watch the movie.
well, if you get a series going or web series going, definitely let us know. I'll be very happy
There's
to
no
spread the
question.
word about that.
No question.
All
I
right.
can't say how much we appreciate the help. As I mentioned to you, privately, as an independent feature that doesn't have huge bucks to spend on advertising, it really is important for us to reach the fans and reach fans of sci-fi, reach fans of horror, reach fans of interesting independent features. And we can't say how much, on behalf of everybody who's involved with Nightmare Code, thank you so much for this opportunity.
No problem whatsoever. The let's see, you said Nightmare Code is available now on various digital platforms and will be available on DVD towards the end of November, which.
We encourage people, if they go to iTunes and they like the movie, or Google Play, to write reviews and help to raise us in the rankings over there so that more people can be infected by Roper.
Ah, nice. And I myself am looking forward to the DVD slash Blu-ray because I love commentaries and I want to jump right into that one. But again, thank you for your time today. The movie is Nightmare Code. We will have links to all the various places you can currently and in the future find it. Thank you again, Mark.
Thank you, Simon.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
There's a little superhero in all of us. Listen to Krypton Radio every day, and we'll help you find yours.
I absolutely love conversations like that one, where you get to really, really talk to the creator, get to dig into the story, really, really figure out or find out what makes that story so unique and compelling and interesting and just fun. And yes, I am recommending that people check out Nightmare Code as soon as they can. It's on iTunes, it's on Amazon. And trust me, as soon as it's available on DVD, I will be, like I said before, pimping the hell out of that. Because I want to hear the creator commentary. I adore creator commentaries. Sometimes when reviewing a DVD, a good commentary can make up for an average movie. And that is something you don't see a whole lot of anymore with DVD releases for indie movies and some of the direct-to-video releases. I think producers and creators are missing out on something. I don't know, something special, something interesting, something different. Mostly because so many of these releases, like I said, don't have any extras, any commentaries on them. And I don't understand why they don't realize that those extras could actually translate into more sales. Especially if the extras are unique. The movie Debug. I would have loved if David Hewlett could have done a creator, director, writer commentary for that movie. Given what he said about the making of it, I can understand why maybe the distributors didn't want that on there. But hey, what's stopping him from recording his own audio commentary track and putting it out there as a free MP3 for people to play along with when they're watching the movie? I mean, Sci-Fi Channel's Battlestar Galactica did that with their podcast commentaries. They would put the podcast out there and say, okay, press play now in order to be in sync with what's on the TV screen. We could do that for movies, indie movies. Another movie I reviewed called The Device. The movie was okay. I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I would. The creator commentary on that was interesting because they actually did go into a little bit of detail on how those shots were made. But there was also a second commentary track, which was an interview with filmmaker, writer Tracy Torme, who did Fire in the Sky. And that interview had nothing to do with the movie. They just interviewed him for about an hour and a half, which was the entire length of the movie. And that was the most fascinating interview I had heard. And the fact that it was buried on this DVD with no hint about why it was on there completely boggled me from a marketing standpoint. How do you have that kind of interview on there and just put it in there as an afterthought in the liner notes? Because the way it's worded on the back of the DVD, it seems like Tracy Torme had something to do with the making of The Device when he didn't. It was just an interview the producers did with someone who was well-versed in the UFO abduction community because of his research in making Fire in the Sky and working with Travis Walton. And that literally is the only tie that interview has to the movie, because the movie has a subtext of UFO abduction in it. And it was a great interview. And probably no one will hear it because they won't, even the people who buy the DVD won't check it out unless someone says, hey, you need to listen to this track here. So, yes, I am looking forward to the commentary track that will be on Nightmare Code. I think I will figure out a way to finagle a contest giveaway for that when the DVDs hit. I'll have to ask about that. So we'll see. But check out Sean's review of Nightmare Code. There's a link to that review from the show notes. And if you can, go watch it. It is definitely worth the watch. It takes a few minutes to get used to the quad screen setup, the split screen format. But once you do, you literally can't take your eyes away from it. But that will do it for this episode of Slice of Sci-Fi. If you have any questions or comments, call in. That number is 602-635-6976. Or you can just record your own commentary or review and email that to summer@sliceofscifi.com. Someone mentioned to me SpeakPipe. I can look at that, make it easier for people on their devices or desktops to just record a message right there on the website. I'll look into it. I like technology, as you all know. Leave a review for the show on iTunes. If you are an iTunes subscriber, jump in there. Let everybody know what you like about the show, what you don't like about the show. If there's something you don't like about the show, tell me first, okay? check us out on Twitter, @SliceOfSciFi. Check us out on Google Plus, that is plus.google.com/+SliceOfSciFi, I think. We still are putting up videos on our YouTube channel. It's youtube.com/SliceOfSciFi. We have not really a review, but an overview of the many missteps that have happened in the Fantastic Four movies, all of them, that Noah and Darren have given a good, comprehensive history and dissection of, because the question came up, how could one of the most popular Marvel franchises have failed so utterly more than one time, more than two times, when it comes to being put on the big screen? So they tackle that question. come to the website. The website is sliceofscifi.com. The new stuff is going on over at writersafterdark.com. Not sure when there'll be a show there, but give it time. A little bit of time. And also, kickassmysticninjas.com does have a brand new website, or brand new website face. Go over there. There are plans in the works to get that show up and running again soon as well. Your donations are welcome. Thank you very much for everyone who's helping support the show here. Not just the show, the websites, the hosting for the websites, the hosting for the media files, all of that. All of that needs supporting, and your help in getting all that paid for is welcomed and appreciated. Yes, there is a Patreon page now. It's not live yet. I haven't launched it yet. But when the time comes, it will be at patreon.com/sliceofscifi. You will be able to support Slice of Sci-Fi, Kick-Ass Mystic Ninjas, and Writers After Dark, and even all the websites that still host the media for the old shows, like Babylon Podcast and Dragon Page and Charlie Jade. Remember that one? All of those shows are still alive and kicking. You can find them in iTunes. You can find them at their various websites. So enjoy. And once the Patreon page gets going, I hope you'll enjoy the various levels of rewards. The one level I want to get is the live show. And like I said, with a little bit of slack, I will be able to focus on fixing that. Another level that's being considered is guest ninja. Guest ninja status, we get to pick a guest ninja, and that guest ninja will then provide a classic science fiction, fantasy, or horror book or movie for us to discuss. So this could be a good way for all those people who had suggestions on what ninjas should cover. Be a ninja and bring a topic with you that we can discuss. I think that'll be fun. My thanks again go to Sci-Fried for the music, to my old friend Tim Callender for the artwork, and to all of you for continuing to listen and hopefully enjoy the shows, the interviews, the discussions that we're providing. We're still geeking out over for our benefit and yours. But that'll do it. We'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.